This is Radio Freethinker, episode 84.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From Mona Vista to the Vancouver Island. From the Arctic Circle to the Great Lake Waters. This land was made for you and me.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley.
This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land. From Mona Vista to the Vancouver Island. From the Arctic Circle to the Great Lake Water. This land was made for you and me. When the sun came shining and I was strolling and the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds.
Hello and welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
This is Chloe, member of UBC Freethinkers.
And this is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club.
I should point out, if you hear the occasional weird noise, we have a photographer documenting our life in the radio station and all that. I'm hoping someday it'll turn out to be a book and maybe even a movie starring, I don't know, somebody famous for me and bit actors for the rest of you guys.
Who would play you?
I don't know. I'd like someone intelligent like Stephen Fry, but maybe someone good-looking like, I don't know. But speaking of exciting things, Ethan, you've just come back from the great deep south, and you've been to some conference that involved some humans and some secularism and a combination thereof. Tell us about your adventures.
That was very succinct. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I have just gotten back from the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah,
very deep. almost 2 hours away. As you know, it was the Secular Humanism Conference, the next 30 years. That's the title of the conference. It was put on by the Council for Secular Humanism and the Center for Inquiry.
So was there an irony to hold a secular convention in the City of Angels?
Yes, there was.
Okay.
That was part of the plan.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually had a really good time at this conference. It was very interesting. The talks, unlike, say, TAM, the Amazing Meeting, or some of the other conferences we've been to, where a lot of the material is stuff that we already know inside and out, or, you know, it's something that is kind of old hat for us, this conference had a lot of content that I had never heard about before. And it was presented in a way that was very interesting for me as someone who's more interested in the skepticism side, not so much in the humanism side. I learned a lot, and I found it just absolutely fascinating. I also saw some very familiar faces and met some interesting people that haven't met before. So, very good time for me.
Excellent. So, in this exciting conference, did you actually learn anything?
Oh, I learned much. In fact, some of the panels, which I'm going to discuss now, I learned quite a bit from. In fact, this panel, that the first panel of the conference was entitled The First 30 Years of Secular Humanism. And it featured James Randi, Tom Flynn, Ed Buckner, and Paul Kurtz. Randi, everyone knows, James the Amazing Randi, discussed the perception that believers were stupid and also how religious scam artists also happened to have large empires of wealth and often employ a team of legal experts to protect them from legal accusations and other interesting things. He told a story about how the BBC did a expose, I think, on Peter Popoff, and Popoff threatened to sue the BBC, and the BBC backed down.
Well, isn't that part of the Protestant work ethic or whatever? You know, if you are successful, God will reward you with money. So these scam artists are obviously doing God's work because they're getting rich from it, right? I mean, that makes
sense.
That
sounds more Calvinist. Anyway.
Calvin was a Protestant.
That's true. Okay, whatever.
You should read a history book.
Thank you. I think I will do that next time. Tom Flynn, who's the editor of Free Inquiry magazine, discussed the issue of blasphemy and how Free Inquiry has a long history of blaspheming. Very interesting discussion. In fact, there was some interesting Canadian content. According to Tom, Chapters and Indigo and the whole Chapters empire actually banned an issue of Free Inquiry because it depicted the Danish cartoons.
Really?
Actually, I thought, well, no, it wasn't Free Inquiry, it was the Western Standard. That the Western Standard had published the cartoons, and the next edition was banned by, I think, Chapters Indigo, which left everyone scratching their head. You know, if you were doing it because of the cartoons, why didn't you do the one with the issue? And it was almost retaliatory.
If I'm not mistaken, Chapters bans quite a few books from their stores for content they deem questionable, anything that might offend the public.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that rare for them.
Which is kind of surprising, because I've definitely picked up books with what could be argued as offensive material at Chapters. Like, it's happened. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. It was a really neat discussion that we had about that. Ed Buckner, who is the former president of American Atheists, he discussed how satire should be used in the free thought movement, of the opinion that it should be used all the time and on everybody.
You sure he wasn't just joking?
Actually, yeah, maybe he was. Of course, Paul Kurtz, the founder of CFI and the Council for Secular Humanism and Free Inquiry, discussed criticism of religion and whether or not it was getting nasty. Kurtz is probably in the camp of the so-called accommodationists, the people who don't want to offend people. So that was an interesting talk. He also discussed sort of the distinction between humanism and atheism, how one is sort of a moral ethical system and one is a lack of a belief system. So that was quite interesting. After that, though, there was a panel on confrontation versus accommodation, the whole argument that's been going on for quite a while now, moderated by Jennifer Michael Heck and featuring Chris Mooney, who is the co-host of Point of Inquiry and the author of several books, The Republican War on Science, and I think there's another one like Failing Science or something like that. Eugenie Scott, who is the director of the National Center for Science Education, probably one of the people most responsible for keeping intelligent design out of the school system. There was also P.Z. Myers of Feringula. I don't think I need to recap P.Z. here. And Victor Stenger, author of God, The Failed Hypothesis. That was a really interesting panel. Almost no agreement across the board. Chris Mooney is famous for the whole framing the issue point of view of trying to present science in a way that's not going to offend people. And he stressed that we need to avoid fighting amongst ourselves, suggesting a more accommodating approach and citing the evidence that when people learn something that goes against their political views, so for example, a global warming denier learning about the science behind global warming will cause that denier to become more of a denier and less informed about the issue.
But how's that actually work? I mean, let's use the United States as a great model, right? I mean, you have the progressives, liberals on there, you know, trying to have an informed, educated debate, and then you get the Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity's or whatever on the other side who are just sitting there saying, you're stupid, and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, the net effect seems to be a much more shift to the insane than to the rational. I mean, how did anyone ask him that particular question, especially in an American context?
Well, not actually at this conference, no, but at a previous concert where conference where I saw Chris Mooney, someone did. And his big thesis for that was how ClimateGate, there was all this real accurate science out there, but compared to all the pseudoscience and the fear-mongering won out. And if anything, ClimateGate resulted in more people doubting climate research, even though all that science was out there trying to be presented in a clear, concise way.
No, that actually goes right to my point. I mean, there were the moderates who said, listen, this kind of proves our point. Look at this. Here's all the things, right? Scientists are humans. Whereas the deniers, the not rational individuals, are sitting there, see, they're lying to us. And they have this confrontational, asshole-ish type approach, and they won the day.
Yeah, that's kind of, I think what we're saying here is, so Chris Mooney is suggesting the opposite is true.
But factual evidence proves it.
Yeah, well, that's why there was disagreement. P.Z. Myers hammered home the point that we don't get much through compromising on the truth. He suggested that by focusing on the symptom of a problem, for example, if creationism is a symptom, religion is the cause, that it does no good to focus on the symptom, but rather the problem, the root cause of the issue. So Pizzi is obviously saying here, we can't compromise our integrity by allying ourselves with religious organizations, even if they favor teaching evolution in schools. Now, that's a very controversial point, and Eugenie Scott is one of the first people who's going to disagree with that point of view right away, and she did. She made several statements suggesting that you don't need to be an atheist to believe in evolution, and you don't need to be, if you believe in evolution, you don't necessarily have to not be religious. And she said that because intelligent design cannot be tested or doesn't meet any basic requirements of science, it's a religion and should be kept out of schools. But she says that there's no reason you can't believe in God and accept evolution. Now, Victor Stender disagreed almost completely. He came out and said, if you believe in God-guided evolution, that's not Darwinian evolution, that's intelligent design. And so it was a really, really back-and-forth debate. I was very impressed with it.
In fact, actually, I think, if I'm remembering my facts correctly here, and someone's welcome to challenge me and email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com, that's one of the issues that's playing out now in the Islamic world, is that most Muslims are quite willing to believe in natural evolution, but they don't believe in human evolution, that human was a specific creation of God. And that's where this accommodationalist approach runs up against walls, where you say, well, you know, yes, it's maybe a good fiction to begin with, but it's like Plato and his noble lies, right? I mean, if you allow the lie to exist, it's on a very weak foundation. So if you're a Christian evolutionist, sure, that's better than a young earth creationist religionist, but you're still your foundation is still weak and prone to collapse.
Right, that's a good point. I don't want to summarize every talk and panel because there was a fair amount, but if you check out our webpage, www.radiofreethinker.com, I'll have a detailed blog post about the conference. However, there were a few points that I did want to bring up, a few negative points. Now, I don't mean to, you know, poo-poo all over the conference and everything, but there were a few issues that I thought needed to be addressed. One, I was hoping to come home with a number of interviews, like I did at TAM. Unfortunately, that's not the case here, and there was no detailed or documented interview schedule that was given to me, or as far as I know, any of the other people who had podcasts, unless, of course, your point of inquiry. Now, that's kind of frustrating for me. I don't know if you guys also feel that frustration, but I think it's a little unfortunate.
So, but at least point of inquiry got some good groundbreaking interviews, right?
P.Z. Myers wrote a blog post. To quote him, "We did an impromptu point of inquiry podcast this afternoon." Which could appear at any time now. I'm going to go listen to Sam Harris for a few hours, so I probably will be busy when it goes online. I wouldn't listen to it anyway.
Really?
Now, I think he's being a little tongue-in-cheek, but still, I mean, this is a missed opportunity to promote this conference to the skeptical community. I mean, you think about TAM, for instance. Every skeptical podcast talks about TAM. Those that attend get several interviews. We had Michael Shermer, Jennifer Michael Hecht. We had Joe Nickel. You know, I know The Reality Check had James Randi and DJ Grothy. Skeptically Speaking did a number of great interviews. So, I mean, there's lots of content out there, and it's a great way to promote it. It's a great way to get people interested in the skeptical movement. But unfortunately, for some reason, that wasn't done for this conference. And that's a shame, because the humanism angle is something that I think often gets underwritten a little bit in this whole free thought movement. So I'm disappointed that the organizers didn't go to greater lengths to reach out to the podcasting community.
To go along the whole idea of aggressive versus compatibilist things, and just to debate some of the things we talked about before, how much responsibility do you think it was on you as someone seeking an interview to get the interviews versus them to do all the work for you? I mean, you told me you did try and get some interviews prior to this on your own.
Exactly. Well, see, that's the problem with these conferences, is that because of the way that they're structured and the time frame that the speakers have to deal with, it's very difficult for them to say they're going to be in a certain place at a certain time. I mean, if a talk runs long or if there's technical problems, or if something isn't working properly, or they get lost. They're not from the city after all, right? So there's lots of things that can go wrong. The organizers, if they create a schedule, not only does it allow the speakers to stick to it, but it allows podcasts to guarantee they're going to get something. I approached several speakers, and while they were all most of the time polite and nice about it, they said, well, okay, if I have some time, come find me. That's a hard thing to do at a conference with several hundred people, to find one person. I did have an extended conversation with Richard Dawkins. I asked him if he'd be interested in doing an interview for us. He responded that, I can't do a good Richard Dawkins impression, but he said, you know, I do so many interviews. Can't you just download one of those? And I mean, like, I guess.
That's where you need to have the hook question, where you sit there and you say, so, well, no, you haven't probably covered this. What do you think of China buying British hobnob companies? And he's just like, what?
He would say that, wouldn't he? Yeah.
I love hobnobs. When did this happen?
Right. And you're right. I mean, like, I suppose I could have gotten some 5 or 3 minute interviews, gotten some, you know, hi, I'm PZ Myers and I'm at this conference. But, you know, I think what we want is substance. We don't want the short, soundbitey interviews. We want to actually sit down with somebody and have a real conversation, like we did at TAM. I mean, those interviews, I thought, were very enlightening. And, you know, I don't want to go into the direction of having these short kind of, you know, mainstream radio kind of like, you know, this is Mick Jagger, you're listening to the Fox or something. You know, like, that's just not what we're up for, right?
You don't do a Mick Jagger impersonation.
I don't do any British impressions, actually.
It was a slightly Richard Dawkins on some sort of drug, Mick Jagger, frankly. Anyway, I was going to ask if the people at the conference who were speaking had to organize themselves. Was part of the problem that they didn't have anyone to organize their time for them?
Oh, no, it was carefully organized. Oh, okay. The difficulty was that they had one gentleman handling all of the media. So his priorities were general media inquiries, and there was actually a write-up in the Los Angeles Times. I don't know if any of you guys saw it. It was ridiculous. Point of inquiry, which is actually quite the to-do. They have like a portable studio that they take around with them. It's quite the thing. And then any other media-related issues. He was also responsible for live streaming some of the sessions, setting up the microphones. Overworked fellow. I actually told the organizers, listen, I will volunteer next time to handle all your podcasting responsibilities. Whether they take me up on that option will remain to be seen. But that's enough about me ranting and raving about this conference. Let's go to a commercial break. We'll come back with some more here on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in 5 words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie, to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. So
your conference wasn't the only one going on. Did you know that, Ethan?
I did not know that.
There was, well, conference might be a bit of a stretch of the term, but there was this old guy named Nobel, Alfred Nobel, who created these prizes. And anyone who's been listening to the blogosphere or the news or whatever has been inundated with the recent announcements of the Nobel Prizes.
Wait. We're not going to talk about all the science awards again. Every podcast does that.
Yeah, no. You know, I was going to because they're really engaging. But after about the 53rd podcast I heard talking about the difference between the chemistry Nobel Prize and the physics Nobel Prize, I just said, no. We're gonna go with one of our strengths, and we're gonna actually talk about the other Nobel Prizes. I'm gonna start off by talking about Nobel Prize in fiction. I mean economics, was awarded to Diamond, Mortson, and Pissarides. Thank you. Who developed a particular model in a paper they published in 1977 called Unemployment Insurance and Job Creation. The idea of their model was to distinguish between cyclical and structural unemployment. Cyclical unemployment being, you know, that's caused by the business fluctuations, business cycles, market crashes. You know, we had the market, the housing crash, and we had the dot-com crash. Those are sort of cyclical. Versus structural unemployment, which are things that are based, you know, like in unemployment insurance, which is really at the root of their work. The traditional view before they came around largely was that unemployment insurance should be held low and be short, because that way their people have a stronger incentive to get back to work. Well, a lot of what this model did was to disprove the naive assumptions behind that.
That's not quite as simple as it is. To further explain them with better evidence. It's not quite as simple as saying, okay, that's absolutely not true. It's just true to a certain extent.
That's where the naive comes into it, and I'm glad you pointed the naive part of it out. The policy implications of what they did was essentially to show that during times of high unemployment, benefits should be high and long in duration so as to ensure that labor is allocated in the right areas.
You mean during low unemployment?
No, that's actually, you're right. I read this and it sounded counterintuitive to begin with, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, you figure with low unemployment, you want to get the people out there quickly. But what they showed is that people become desperate for jobs, and high-skilled people take low-skilled jobs, which, one, make them, in the economic parlance, underproductive. And it also denies those people who have the lower skills from participating as well. So it's sort of a double whammy. So you should actually, during times of low high unemployment, make benefits good and long durations.
Low unemployment, because during times of low unemployment, you don't have this problem of mass unemployment. You mostly just have people who are
So when there's lots of people unemployed, you want high benefits and you want them for a long duration. That's what this says.
That's not what you wrote down here.
Yeah, I know. I put the word low twice. If you notice, I put it twice. That was a typo.
That's really fascinating for radio.
So you corrected me. You corrected me great here. So during, and this is the counterintuitive part of it, is that during high unemployment, you actually want to have high benefits and long durations so that people find the job best suited for them, because it's a natural form of unemployment, right? They're not out of the job market because they want to be out of the job market. They're out of the job market because there literally is no job. So you want them to self-select the best job for them. Whereas when you have low unemployment, you want low benefits and short durations, because essentially during low unemployment they're unemployed because they want to be unemployed, and you want to give them the pressure to get back in the job market.
So is the idea that the government is sort of giving you a roundabout loan until you can get a job that will make you as productive as possible?
Yeah, well, this is where, and we discussed before about the overused term of Keynesian, is it's sort of, it's counter-cyclical, right? So you're kind of doing the reverse of what you think you should do to go against the cycle. So unemployment is high, and you figure, well, you want to get the people out there, but if you do that, if you force them into the job market too quickly, it's actually more inefficient, because it's like I say, you're working against the
It seems to me what you're saying is not what they were getting at. And mind you, I didn't have time to read the paper that this was based on, so I'm going off of economic textbooks, which have mentioned this before, and other things they've said. But they themselves said that getting people back into the workforce right now should be the paramount problem when you have high unemployment. But what you're saying they were saying is that during times of high unemployment, you should have the high benefit so that they wait longer to get back in.
Well, that's the naive part that comes into it, right? Is they're not waiting to come into the market. What they're doing is they're trying to find the best fit for them, mm-hmm. because it's an unnatural unemployment. They're not unemployed because they want to be. They've been forced to be unemployed. So there already is a pressure for them to get the job. But you want to make sure they get the job at which they will be the most productive. Because when you have high unemployment, people will choose jobs that are beneath their capacity, which means they are underproductive in the economy. And like I say, they also force out people who are better suited for that job who are not producing at all. So it creates a negative feedback on the economy. Whereas if you just allow them a bit extra breathing space, they will more efficiently reintegrate into the economy. Now, that doesn't work when there's low unemployment, because the low unemployment is what you would call natural unemployment. That's where people aren't in the job market because they don't want to be in the job market. They're being picky, and that's when you want to put the pressure on them to get back into work, because there is no other pressure for them to get into work. It's a low unemployment, there's lots of demand for their skills, so they can be picky. And that's where you want to apply the pressure, not in the other case.
Does someone want a prize for this?
Yeah, well, I did mention fiction. That's just one of the prizes, and obviously this will spark a lot of debate on our forum and our blog or whatever, because I'm sure people will want to do their own research and correct whoever is wrong, probably not me. And so you can comment on our blog at radiofreethinker.com, or go to email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Other awards that were given out, and I'll mention this briefly, Vargas Llosa, won Nobel Prize for Literature. He's Latin American one, and he's famous for coining the phrase that Mexico is the perfect dictatorship. He won, and I quote, for his cartography of the structure of power and entrenched images of individual resistance, revolt, and defeat. Now, I thought that was kind of interesting for a literature prize, because it seemed very political in its nature. And that goes on with the next one, which is the Nobel Peace Prize, which was awarded to the Chinese dissident Lo Jubao, who won for his long struggle of nonviolence and fundamental human rights in China. The Nobel Rights Committee says that it believes there's a close relationship between human rights and peace, so that's why even though he's human rights, they gave him the Peace Prize. He was put in jail for 11 years for spreading a message of subversion, subverting the country and authority. Actually, his wife gave him the notice, and right after she gave him the notice, they put her under house arrest, which I thought was ironic, but the Chinese government has its own way. But he's promoting something called Chapter 8. Essentially, Chapter 8 it's a Chinese movement to, apparently mirrored after a Czechoslovakian Chapter 77, which again, I'm not too sure on that one. Our historian would know, maybe.
Well, is that referring to Czechoslovakia's rebellion against the Soviet Union?
I believe so, yeah. Anyhow, the Chapter 8 basically calls for traditional or theoretical Western-style democracy, so separation of powers, independent judiciary, non-party-controlled elections, and public accountability. People may or may not know that China does actually have elections regularly, but they're not what we would think of as elections, because you have to be a party member and the party has a lot of influence over who gets there, but there's still a popular vote over who does get it. He also wants equality of people, largely between rural and urban, because apparently there's a huge divide in China between the two, human rights, freedom of association, assembly, expression. He has a few that are a little bit less big on my book, protection of private property, financial and tax reform, guaranteed social security, civil education, protection of the environment, as well as a truth and reconciliation process to go through all the sort of crimes against its people that the communist government has done. You know, there's the big one is usually the Tiananmen Square incident or massacre, depending on how you're doing it. And the idea is to do what they did in South Africa, is not to convict or charge anyone with it, but just say, this is something we need to deal with, and let's deal with it. I mean, Canada has its own with its schools.
Residential schools.
The last one one of the ones he has, which I really totally disagree with, is he also believes in freedom of religion, which I think is subsumed into association or freedom of belief. I don't think you need a separate one, but that's my atheism coming through.
Well, it's probably swinging the other way from communism, which is notoriously atheistic.
Well, yeah, that's where you get a lot of misreads in history. I mean, a lot of the quote-unquote great either leftist or rightist, we're not as left or right as we tend to think of them. It's just in contrast to their culture, their current historical context, they said, well, we got to get rid of all businesses. Well, not because they really wanted to get rid of all businesses, but the businesses of the time were rather radical. Just one last note. Like I say, there's been some controversy, especially over the Nobel Peace Prize. Traditionally, the Nobel Peace Prize were given to what they call peacemakers. People like Wilson, who created the League of Nations, Roosevelt, who negotiated treaties, our own Pearson for the peacekeepers. But it changed around the 60s to give out what I call ethical awards to people who are ethically noble people. Martin Luther King being an example, Andrei Sakharov, Ahn Chu Li. And we had a debate before the show about whether, you know, it's important to have the Nobel Peace Prize should be for something you've done or something you believe in, and if there's a difference.
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I would like to hear what our listeners have to say. You can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Let's go to a commercial break, though, and we'll be back. We're going to discuss some sacred space.
We shall.
Yes.
Yes.
Be very interesting. Stay tuned.
Hello, everybody. My name is David Dichter. I sing with MDC, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And I hope you have a great day, and kill the cop in yourself, and hopefully the rest will follow.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Chloe, you're going to tell us a bit about some sacred space. What is sacred space?
Well, it's an interesting question. Sacred space tends to be something that's fought over by a faith in this particular instance. What we're referring to today, or we're talking about today, rather, is the Babri Masjid controversy in India. Not a lot of Canadian and American, etc. I don't know how many American listeners we have, but not a lot of Canadian listeners are going to know about this, so I'm going to provide you with some history, and we're going to get into the issue of sacred space. So, in 1992, in Ayodhya, Uttar Pradesh, India, rioters tore down a mosque known as the Babri Masjid, which had originally replaced a Hindu temple some 450 years before. Over 2,000 people died in the riots that followed. A court battle ensued to determine who truly had the right to this land, and the verdict was announced in September of this year. So, just as a disclaimer, there are a lot of players in this controversy, and any listener should keep in mind that the history of this issue is going to be somewhat simplified just for time's sake and for sanity's sake. So, the...
Sanity. Wait, you said this is about religion. Okay, continue on.
Throw sanity to the wind and just bear with us. The Babri Masjid site was originally home to a Hindu temple, as I've said. The site is known as Janmabhoomi, and is supposed to be the birthplace of Ram, the seventh avatar of the Hindu god Vishnu. In 1528, which is the year after the founder of the Mughal dynasty Babur came to power in northern India, a temple was either torn down or was modified to create the Babri Masjid, which is a mosque, as we've said. The first riot that we have on record, at any rate, that broke out over this mosque occurred in 1853 under the British. So, in the ensuing 157 years, the site has been disputed in and out of court. It has been locked and unlocked. Both Muslims and Hindus have had, at different times, been denied access to the site, and it has been a source for disharmony between Indian Muslims and Indian Hindus. which, I mean, there are many sources of disharmony, but this is one of the big ones, with both sides saying they have right to ownership of the land. So in 1989, an organization called the Vishnu Hindu Parishad, or VHP, which is an international Hindu organization, moved to place the foundation stones for a temple to Ram on the Babri Masjid site. And at this point, the mosque still existed. So it greatly intensified the issue, and finally in 1992, a group of rioters tore down the mosque. A commission probing the cause of the riot was leaked to the press. Originally, it wasn't going to be released, and the results of the commission indicated that the riot and demolition had been planned by top members of the second largest political party in India, called the Bharatiya Janata Party, and they're basically a very nationalist, right-wing, and predominantly Hindu party that was in power in India for a number of years, something like 10 or 12 years. So, a court case ensued to determine which religious group owned the property rights to the land, and the verdict was announced this September. It should be noted that during this whole process, pieces for a Ram temple have been in construction and are ready to be put together. It's also important to keep in mind that there are several suits in this case, but the title suit was the question of ownership. So the Allahabad High Court, and I'm sorry I don't know very much about the Indian legal system, but the Allahabad High Court, whatever that might mean, announced that the land would be divided into three, part to the Hindus, one part to the Muslims, and a third part to the Nirmohi Akara, which is another Hindu denomination.
So this is the King David method of justice.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, in a country that's famous for partition, I suppose this makes sense in some ways. It also declared that this site is indeed the birthplace of Ram, and that the mosque was constructed against the principles of Islam. In addition, the court also declared that the mosque was built with parts of the old Hindu temple and that these 2.7 acres are an official Hindu site of worship. Now, in, ironically enough, The Hindu, which is an Indian newspaper, an article appeared on October 1st, 2010, which in my opinion really summed up one of the biggest problems with this ruling. And the quote goes, quote, "For every Hindu who believes the spot under the central dome of the mosque is the precise spot where Lord Ram was born, there is another who believes something else. But leaving aside the question of who the Hindus referred to by the court really are and how their actual faith and belief was ascertained and measured, it is odd that a court of law would give such weight to theological considerations and constructions rather than legal reasoning and facts." So there is some discussion about the validity of this ruling, and basically what this boils down to is that two religious groups, two faith groups, were fighting over this site, and the court decided to use faith as part of the basis for its ruling. So,
you know,
that's a problem.
I will give it, at least there's a certain internal consistency, right? I mean, if you have a fictional complaint, you should use the same fiction to sort of resolve it. Then at least you're sort of all playing by similar rules, if not the same rules.
But the problem here is that India is on the books anyway, a secular state. And they've used theology as evidence, in short, as part of the ruling.
Well, could you cast their ruling as more just historical recognition of what people have believed? So even though no one, even say the court, believes that this Ram guy was born there, mm-hmm. but the fact that it had precedence in historical templates, right? If I followed everything correctly. And so in that sense, that cultural meme takes precedent over other cultural memes, independent of the religious overtones.
It's an interesting point. I mean, I think one of the biggest problems here is there's a really huge history of basically abuse of the Muslim minority in India, and that's one of the reasons why setting a precedent like this, despite historical precedences, is so problematic.
So exactly, who were the plaintiffs and the players? I mean, was it just sort of like one side was the Hindu portion of the population and one side was the Muslim portion of the population? Did they actually have, is there like an ownership committee for both groups that are claiming?
I think the people who are looking after the Hindu side of the argument is this VHP, this International Hindu Organization. And on the Muslim side, I believe it's a Sunni organization, and I think it's local to Ayodhya, but I'm not positive about that.
Hmm.
So, I mean, I think this particular incident raises a really interesting issue because, I mean, we can all think of other places in the world that are fought over by religions, the Dome of the Rock or the Wailing Wall in Israel. The Buddhas of Bamiyan, a lot of people don't know, but they very, very old Buddhist statues that were torn down by the Taliban. And the Taliban, at the time, said when they tore down the Buddhas, all we're breaking is stones. Now, they have a point, But there is such a huge, as you were saying before, historical and archaeological value to these sites that...
Yeah, actually, the Buddhist statues that were destroyed, and I remember starkly when they were. It's something that stood out. And I didn't think it was a religious crime. It was, but there were these historical monuments. They were, 13th century, I believe, statues that were created, and they were destroyed. They were part of the human... cultural heritage, right? I mean, in the same way that you don't have to be a Catholic to appreciate the Sistine Chapel, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the pictures in there are beautiful, irrespective of the religious context. So in that sense, I was actually, and I feel really embarrassed that I was actually for the Afghanistan War because of that. But I've corrected my opinion since then. But there's another aspect to this too, and I wonder if we can try and do this. What if the American government and the Mexican government wanted to fight over the Alamo? They both wanted to claim it as historically significant, because I mean it was. I mean the Mexicans did win the Alamo and the Americans lost, but they have different things. I mean, would this still translate into that kind of a context? Because the whole idea of sacred, I mean, we use it as a religious term, but I mean it means, you know, something that's really, really special to our people, however you define our people.
You get into an interesting point. I mean, should these sites be given special treatment because they are religious sites? I would say if a fight like that broke out over the Alamo, people would be up in arms just as much as they would be if the site were religious.
Or a mosque in New York.
The other difficulty, though, that we're dealing with is that this is within a sovereign state. It's in India, right? Like, it's not like another nation outside of India is trying to claim it.
Yeah.
We have two cultural ethnic groups fighting over the same plot of land. To get to the point on sort of cultural heritage, I think that, you know, my method would be to say, well, look, it's obviously a place of some importance, but who owns that importance? I would say it's the collective people who call themselves Indian. That's the nearest I think I could come to a fair ruling on that one, because, like, I mean, honestly, do I own the CN Tower?
No, you
don't. By virtue of being Canadian, by virtue of liking the CN Tower, do I own it? I mean, no. Yes.
I think they should just auction it off. It's the it's the fairest way to determine who has it.
So then, like, Coca-Cola can buy it or something.
Yeah, anyone can buy it. Someone could buy it and then charge admission if they wanted. Like,
well, there's actually a good question, though. Whoever owns this, are they going to use this as... For what purpose will they use it? Will they have, like... Will they make money off this?
I imagine that there will be collections... You know, in the sort of the way that we're used to. I assume most of the people in the room are from Christian backgrounds, at least ancestrally. So, I mean, the idea of collecting money for a temple or for a mosque is not in that way they will make money. But mostly, it's going to be used for worship. But the fact that they're going to be sharing the same space, 2.7 acres, is really not a big area. I mean, I think the ruling was orchestrated in a way to get rid of tension, but that's not going to work.
Yeah, I mean, the obviously having the Dome of the Rock on top of the Wailing Wall has relieved so much tension in Jerusalem. I mean, because they all live together harmoniously now that they can all practice their religion. I think Ethan was going on one thing, and we're going to go with the secular side of it. So there is right now a building there.
There is.
And
there's the remains of a building.
Right. And that was remains of the mosque, right?
The mosque.
Right. So in essence, by using property rights, that the whatever group represents that Muslim church, they should have sort of a precedent to ownership of that property, at least, because, I mean, they're sort of there.
They are sort of there, but originally, 450 years ago, they weren't. I mean, we have no very good historical record of this. It's very hard to, make those.
Even with a good historical record, it'd be hard to say who owns it from a property rights standpoint, because
you're basically asking which god is more important in their
no, record. But like from a secular property rights standpoint, because it's not an individual or a group that still exists that would have made that. And also, I don't know if Indian law has this, but to what extent does a building or does a land fail to be yours after you, like, no longer there for a while?
Well, define the you in this case.
Well, no. I think you're under a misnomer, and Chloe will do this. When we use the term Hindu and Muslim, we're using that as shorthand, but there are actual legal entities who fought this case. Like, there is an actual denomination of Muslims who are the plaintiffs in this, and there is an actual denomination of Hindus who
raises another question. Why should they get it?
Well, that's actually a good point, because as far as I know, they're not 400-year-old Hindus, are they?
They are not physically 400 years old.
No, so I mean, they're Hindus, yes, and they have a group that they call themselves, that they're a part of, but they're not the same people who built this place.
Well, yeah, but the current queen didn't build Buckingham Palace. It's...
Well, yeah, but we can't justify one problem by pointing out another problem. We need to address this by logic here. There's not really a basis to say that the Hindus in this case own it, because they're not the Hindus who built it. So are they even descended from the same group of people?
Oh, well, no, sorry. Now I'm really confused. Are, in this line of thinking, are you thinking it should be nationalized and just owned by the government? Because I am in favor. I think all property should be owned communally. But I mean, is that where you're going with this?
Well, what I'm saying, though, is
I mean,
as far as I can see, there is no clear-cut line of evidence to indicate that anyone in this situation, aside from perhaps the people who used to administer this mosque, however long ago that was, 10 or so, 20 years ago, who owns it. The Hindus who claim ownership of this are a modern group of people. There's no indication that they've been living there since, other than that they're claiming it as part of their cultural heritage. But what is about their cultural heritage that is more viable than the Muslims' cultural heritage?
I understand what you're asking. I think the answer to what you're asking is because this is the birthplace of an avatar of Vishnu, that's what makes it culturally so important to Hindus. Not so much religiously, even like the culture of religion, culturally it's important, and that gives them right to it. They feel gives them right to it. Do you see what I'm saying?
Okay, but then why is it just this one group, though?
I think it, to bring in sort of a BC thing, is it's the same reason a lot of native groups feel that they have some sort of right to land. Say, for instance, the university endowment lands, which were sort of given by the British Columbian government to the university, arguably on its land that they never really had. It should have stayed in the hands of native groups. Now, the current people who are arguing this were never on those lands when it was theirs. Mm-hmm. It's just that sort of, they feel like they have a common ancestry to it. And it's definitely a difficult question to answer. I don't think there's a right answer you're never going to come to an agreement.
And just to stop people who might go into, correct me if I'm wrong, Chloe, but you did say this particular mosque has been in dispute. So it's sort of ownership has changed hands in the last 400 years, or?
Yes and no. It's had a really kind of complicated, there'll be an article about, a link to this on our blog for the record. At one time, Muslims were allowed to worship inside the mosque and Hindus were allowed to worship outside. And then there was another thing was dragged through the courts and it was locked permanently and no one was allowed to use it. Do you see what I'm saying?
So my point being is, in theory, because someone will say, well, there are actually natives around alive today whose father lived in this land. So there is theoretically Hindus alive today who worshipped on this ground as a sacred ground. That was the only point. Because someone's going to say, oh, no, the comparison you made is totally wrong. But no, I think it's very relevant, which maybe circles us all back to where Chloe, I think, original issue was, is that, well, there are cultural things that you could, you know, the cultural norms, there are, you know, legal precedents of property rights and all that involved. And all those, I don't think any of us would have a huge issue with, even if we disagreed on the outcome, as using as criteria. But you said in particular that the criteria that was used by this court were theological arguments and not cultural arguments, not legal arguments, but based on the religious texts and that type of thing.
Yeah, the validity of whether or not this was Rome's birthplace and whether or not this was against the principles of Islam to build a mosque there in the first place.
So maybe another, again, because we're using so many equivalents just to confuse people here, if someone was charged with adultery because it was one of the Ten Commandments, and that was a reason given as opposed to some other reasons, we would all get up in arms about that type of thing. We mm-hmm. say, hold it, wait a minute. You know, even if we think adultery is right or wrong, you're using the Bible as the criteria here for judging, and that would be horrible. And I think on that grounds, it brings up a good point.
Well, I mean, exactly. This is a very odd situation. I personally think that I mean, the courts can come up with a conclusion. I mean, you don't necessarily have to like it, but if they use actual evidence, you can at least try to understand their reasoning.
Yeah.
If they're using theology, then, well, that kind of closes the door on any kind of real debate here. It basically just says, well, you have a special connection to heaven, so you apparently know what you're doing. I'd be very disturbed by this if I lived in India.
To go off on that is exactly, if they sit there and they say, well, there's a property right, and you go, well, how do you prove property? Well, there's a, you know, we owned it this long. Well, there's a, you know, a statute of limitations or whatever that we can apply here. Great. But if you say Ram or God was born here, well, I mean, where do you go from there? You can't. And that, full stop, end of discussion. And that's just not something a secular court should be using as a criteria.
So what could they have done alternatively? Like, I mean, how, like, literally, how could this have been settled?
You should create a commune.
I think, you know, it wouldn't have been very satisfactory, probably, anybody involved. But I think that you are going to have to make somewhat arbitrary judgment on this. You're going to have to say, okay, look, you've been there the longest, you guys haven't, they get the land. And there's going to be outrage, there's going to be, oh, no, but lucky.
No, that actually, I'm sorry, I'm going to take offense with the way you, I agree with exactly what you said, but it's not arbitrary, and that's the whole point. It's not arbitrary. There, I mean, if this was a housing unit that you owned and I had owned at one point, and we were disputing on who owned it, there's case law, there's common law, there are things that we could go to and say, it's not arbitrary decision, there is actually a reason, a rationale for this decision. And I think that's how it would be. I mean, there has to be, I mean, just because this is a religious building, there cannot have been disputed lands somewhere else for some other reason in India that hasn't been adjudicated. Those are the criteria you should be using it on, you know, even if it's not religious, you know, two groups claim the same property. Well, you know, use that criteria. Mm-hmm. Using the theological
You're dealing majority here with groups and cultures who have been dead for long periods of time. That's the hairy part. It's not like two individuals are debating over land.
Mm-hmm.
It's two groups, many of whom are long gone, debating over land. And you have these two other groups claiming ancestry to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anytime someone invokes ancestry, I get nervous. So,
well, on that note, then, let's see how you parse this question. So you have very strong opinions about this one. What about Jerusalem and the Palestine, which is...
You want me to solve the Israeli-Palestinian
question? No. But I mean, one... You
it's
know,
all on you
do, do you think that all of the Israeli people or all of the Jewish people, does it fall in the same category? Because, I mean, they claim ancestry and... Maybe not. Some of them have literally lived there since who knows when. There's also between Jews and the Arabs and the Palestinians, etc.
It's problematic because the Israelis that live in Israel now have been living there for some time. Like,
yes.
I mean, this has become home. Like, there's no argument from, well, this isn't really our home.
You could say the same thing, arguably, about even mundane issues like the Canadian-American border.
Mm-hmm.
It was established. It was completely arbitrary. It's like, you know, if Canada says, listen, that, like, 8 feet of land over there looks like Canada. Canadian was there a little while ago. I think we should have it, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
you
at a certain point, these arbitrary nation states are established, and you just kind of have to run with it. It's unfair to a certain degree, but the same with a lot of other situations. I don't know who owns Israel and who owns Palestine, but I'm saying, though, that relying on faith to determine that
mm-hmm.
is ridiculous. And either appeal to former legal cases or make a ruling, do what the courts are supposed to do. Maybe you'll be unpopular for 500 years, but that's unfortunately your result of being on a court. But that's my take on it. And if anyone else has a different take, they can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Let's go to our last commercial break, and we'll be back with more, including some skeptical highlights here on Radio Freethinker.
Life is hard. The world is cold. You're always too young, and then too old. But we've changed all that. Escape from life at the new Waves on How concert series, where you're never too young or too old to rock out with Vancouver's most amazing bands each Friday and Saturday night from 8 p.m. till midnight. Sponsored by Covenant House. Come enjoy the show and donate to Covenant House's Street Youth Services Program. Join the Waves on How Facebook group for all the info. Waves on How is not responsible for smiling, laughing, singing, dancing, or sudden outbursts of complete happiness that may be caused by the Waves on How concert series.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. And we're wrapping things up here after a spirited discussion. It's time for our skeptical highlights of the week. And I have some here that I think are most interesting for our listeners, including later this week, October 15th, CFI Vancouver is hosting the SkepDoc, Dr. Harriet Hall, giving a talk entitled How to Identify Pseudoscience, Quackery, and Fraud at Langara Room A130 at 7:30. General admission is $7, students for $4, and CFI members, as always, for free. So check it out. It's going to be wild.
Cool. I always heard that it kind of has this purplish glow. That's how you can tell pseudoscience, and a bunch of question marks with lines through it. Is that her technique?
You should ask her that.
I will try and make a point of that.
Yes, very good. And remember, later next month, November 20th, CFI Vancouver is presenting a live show of the long-running, very popular science podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, featuring special guest George Harab, and that will be taking place at the Hebb Theater at 2:30. Remember to purchase your tickets online, www.cficanada.ca/Vancouver, for all that information. But what else?
I've got one, actually, and this is pretty much for people who are into this sort of thing. Gwyn Dyer, who was here recently, did a talk at UBC, is coming to Capilano University Theater, and he's talking about his new book called Crawling from the Wreckage. Sorry, I need a new tongue. His book basically talks about how we're gradually emerging from what he calls a dark tunnel of the past decades, marked by, and I quote, exaggerated fears of terrorism, futile and unnecessary wars in the Middle East, neglect of climate change, and financial near collapse. Now, he thinks we're coming out of it. I think we're going into it. But anyhow, he's giving a talk on October 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Capilano Theater. Now, I think this is largely for fans of Gwyn Dyer, because there is a charge for it. It's $25 to go see this, so it's not cheap. But if you're into Gwyn Dyer, you like his work, it might be something you want to check out.
And the UBC Freethinkers have two events this weekend. One, we've teamed up with the SFU Skeptics, and we're going to Body World. For people who don't know that, it's an exhibit at Science World, or the TELUS World of Science, or whatever it's called now.
But what do you think about, I assume we have a minute or two. I've heard a lot about some religious complaints about how this is somewhat sacrilegious to have these dead bodies displayed. I mean, they're real bodies, right? Mm-hmm. And I assume they're dead.
Yeah.
They better be dead.
And how that this is somehow a violation of the dead or whatever.
They all willingly gave consent when they were alive. I don't see a problem. I mean, I guess you could have a reasonable argument about that, like away from religion, possibly, but I don't think we have time, and I'm not going to argue that it's bad.
So when is this?
It's this Saturday, October 16th. Meet outside of Science World, right at the front, at 6:30 p.m. And the cost is $18 per person. That's to Science World, not to us. And also, on Sunday, we're having another monthly Breakfast of Champions. So come out for some good food, good conversation. Tea, coffee. Well, I'm the only one who ever has tea. Everyone else goes for coffee. But
I'm assuming it's going to be a trans-fat free breakfast, you know, with no high fructose enriched syrup, or
If people want to choose that. We don't choose for them. So, that's this Sunday, October 17th. Starts at 10:30 a.m. to whenever people want to stay. And that's at the King's Head Pub, which is 1618 U Street, which is right around the Kitsilano area.
Very easy to get to on the 22, if anyone's wondering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a nice cheap breakfast, so it's pretty handy.
It's like $4 for breakfast.
Yeah,
can't
excellent.
Complain.
You really can.
Probably not healthy for Dawn, but well, it has some meat.
Yeah, it's got meat, so you should be happy about that.
Yeah, no, that doesn't make me feel any more comfortable, because this is after your visit to Body Works, right? I'm not saying that there's a connection here, but
these
dead bodies make me hungry. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinker. So thanks for listening, all the audience out there. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and check out our website at www.radiofreethinker.com and email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And also, we do that Twitter thing, too. And you should check that out, CITRRFT, and that's just fantastic. So, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Chloe.
And this is Daniel saying remember to come look at skinless bodies and then eat breakfast with us.
Did you forget what you said? Or
I wanted to build the anticipation.
I see. That's very good. Oh, well done. Bye-bye, everybody.
Then there's the utter misery.